Welcome to another interview of Israel Tech. I'm excited to have here Yaniv Shor, the founder and CEO of Progio. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for being here.
So first thing I just want to say, we're in Kfar Saba. This is our first interview ever in Kfar Saba. I get out of the train and it's absolutely gorgeous. What a beautiful area. I don't know why more people don't have offices here instead of Tel Aviv. There's just so much green.
Yeah.
And things are so well kept and clean.
Less traffic.
And less traffic.
And you can do everything here. Like if you need to buy something to your house, if you need something, you know, communication, PCs.
Right.
You have everything here.
Yeah,
you can even fix your car.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So, I mean, you're talking about all these different errands that people do. And a big component of that is project management, which is hence named Progio. Mm-hmm. So project management. Why is this important? Aren't there enough management tools? I remember learning in business school about all the different management systems, Gantt, et cetera. And we know that you hate Gantt. You got a little poster over there. What is it? Why is it so important? Why does it keep changing?
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question. This is mainly because not all the work is like ongoing work. You know, there is always work that is related to a specific delivery date, a specific case-by-case need for a customer. And then you need to assign resources for that. You need to define a scope. You need to define the QA criteria. And this is a project at the end of the day. Of course, in a factory, if you keep like manufacturing the same thing again and again, it's not a project. But if you need to move the factory from one location to the other, this is a project.
So how does one know how to do that? Don't they usually go to a consultant who's, let's say, or a company that does moving all the time, helps move warehouses or things? And wouldn't they just go to them and they would take care of the whole thing? Wouldn't bringing in a new solution and a new technology make things more complicated?
Yeah, I think that most of the people learning that as part of the university, like they're doing some basic stuff of how to arrange a work in a way that it will be a project at the end of the day. And then the rest is probably based on experience. When you are, you know, entering a new company, they have a lot of knowledge about the things that they do. And you're learning with time how to run this specific company project. And then you're getting to the point where you need some tools. And this is where we, coming up with like vendors.
But every project is so different.
Yeah. If it's not different, it's not a project. You know, if it's like a repeatable thing.
Okay,
it's
right.
Not a
I get that. So how does your technology able to help people that have unique projects when they're so vastly different? How can you can say we can help you if you're trying to go to Mars or you're trying to move your warehouse?
So it's always it always starts with a planning phase. You know, in the planning phase, you will make a decision. So what are the people that are going to work with me on that project? What will be the work streams that will be part of this project? And then you come up with a plan. Then you have something you can share with people, you can track. And this is your usually your starting point.
Do you think Gantt charts are dead? I don't know if I should admit this to you. For our SEO projects, we use a Gantt.
Mm-hmm.
Why shouldn't I?
I don't think that Gantt charts are dead. You know, they are with us for, 100 and something years. And I was using Gantt charts personally when I started my career as a project manager. And you can plan with that. I think that the world is changing. Now you need to collaborate over a timeline. Now you need to present to management in a different way. The focus on resource management is significantly higher than it was before. And this is why you need more than a Gantt chart. It's not like it's dead. It's just an old technology that can be replaced now with new technology.
So what is this new technology? Like,
the new technology is, you know, when I was a project manager and I was doing that for maybe 20 years.
When were you a project manager?
You know, I was working for companies like
20 years?
Intel.
How old are you?
Yeah. 120.
Okay, that makes sense.
I'm 52. And, I had like 20 years of project management experience before starting my first company. So I'm not a serial entrepreneur. I really grew from being part of big American corporates like Intel and Flextronics and Verifone. And I was seeing the issues firsthand. So this is where I started thinking about the need to have something that is actually different, because I was seeing people managing projects. But they used to do it without tools. They used to do it through project meetings. And I didn't see a tool that is really helping with the day-to-day of a project manager. You know, Gantt chart that you mentioned earlier can help with the planning process, but not with the day-to-day challenges of project manager.
Okay, so I mean, but what goes from the tools we're using aren't perfect, which I think every professional in every field feels like, to let me go and build one. What's up with that? Because you're not an entrepreneur before this, right? This is the first company you found.
Yeah, that's right. But I was a project manager myself.
Right.
And over time, I was seeing that I'm not really using all these solutions that are out there. You know, I'm using Gantt to planning, but then when I'm getting to the project status meeting, I'm not really using that. Then I always come up with something like a PowerPoint slide or even a sketch over a whiteboard. And I was trying to explain people what they're seeing on a whiteboard. It was, you know, many times was successful because the whiteboard can be quite clear and people find it relevant to their work. But then at the end of the meeting, what can you do with a whiteboard? You can take a picture of the whiteboard and then you can send it as attachment to people. And I started thinking, you know, this was back like 2015, 2016. Is that the best way to manage project? Like to send whiteboard pictures into someone's email? And I started thinking that it should be an electronic way to do that. And originally I thought that there are probably ways to do it. And I started looking for tools like that.
When you started looking for tools for yourself.
Yes. And I didn't find any tool that is actually doing that. And then I decided, okay, I'll try to do it myself. And then I was exposed to the complexity of doing that. And I started thinking, oh, it's not as simple as I think.
And then you gave up.
And no. And then I started thinking about interesting idea in doing that. I wrote a book that is behind you, like documenting some of the ideas I have in 2015.
Time to deliver.
Yes. Then I authored 2 patents to protect some of the things that are in the book. Then we started an application.
What are the patents on?
The patents are about the data structure that behind the plans that we're using today and about the visuals, the UI that we finally designed in order to show the project plan. Because the data structure we're using is not similar to the one that is behind the Gantt chart. And it has all kind of what we called before machine learning, but now people are calling it AI, that helps you analyze the project through the way the data set is built.
So you see the problem. You wrote the book before you founded the company.
Yes.
And then what made you decide, okay, I'm now going to go try and solve something?
So you know, I started to write a book without thinking about a company. I was trying to just articulate the ideas I had in the space.
Why write a book? Why not write a blog or something?
You know, just paper. Because I thought that it may be an interesting way to do it. By the way, the book is not like a guide. It's a novel. It's a story about a project manager. And I was trying to deliver the message.
The book, The Goal?
Yeah.
Eliyahu.
Exactly. This was maybe...
What was his last name? Eliyahu?
Goldratt.
Goldratt,
He did that in the 80s.
Maybe you want to talk about it? I read that in my business school at Bar-Ilan University.
Yeah, right. You know, he's a genius. He's really number one in the space, at least used to be back in the 80s. But definitely this book was maybe an idea for me, you know, something I'd like to follow.
Yeah.
So I started to come up with something that will be very different, but will tell, you know, tell approach through a story. I tried to do that and it took me like maybe 4 months because it was not that easy. And as part of doing that, I started to realize that I have something that is maybe more than a story. And this was the point where I started showing it to people. This is, by the way, my recommendation to anyone that has like good idea and want to think about doing something with that. Start showing it to people so you see if it has some traction. If it has some traction, maybe it's a good idea. It should have very strong traction in order to finally be a startup in a company. But I started doing that and people started saying, you know, that's interesting. Maybe you should do something with that. And over time, the idea is stronger than you. Oh, yeah, now you need to do that because you're not going to let someone else do it for you, right? This was the starting point.
Make that a clip, by the way, for the Eliyahu Gold.
Goldratt.
Sorry, for The Goal. It's a great book. Okay.
It's on.
Okay, cool. Continuing. So what made you jump into the pool of entrepreneurship? Did you have other friends that were entrepreneurs? Were people encouraging you to? Were you like spending too much time at home?
All level. No, I think that it was mainly the fact that I was an entrepreneur from day one. At the beginning, I did it inside some of the companies I was working for. So it was always there. But the real thing that made me be like starting my own company was a good idea. I think when you have a good idea, it's an easier decision to make because you see that it has some potential and then you go for it. Without a very good idea, it's very hard to make a decision to live like the comfortable corporate life and be an entrepreneur, which is not very comfortable.
Right. No, it's definitely not. So let's talk about Progio now, and then maybe we'll go back a little to your career. How many people are you? What exactly are you? Tell us, like, what exactly, who are you solving? Who are your clients? What are you changing? Obviously, we're improving project management. Okay. Could be sexier. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could pitch it that way. But, like, how can people see the, understand the changes to businesses and maybe even to individuals or society? What is exactly, what kind of part do you guys play?
So to answer your first question, so today we are a global company. We're spread between this side of the globe in Israel and the US. From Israel, we're handling most of the R&D product side and also Europe. In the US, we're managing the US market, and this includes everything that you need there, from sales to pre-sales to post-sales to marketing and even some development resources. So everything that we need to do in the US is in the US, and the company is like today, like 50-50 between the two locations. The thing that we are doing for our customer, I would divide it into three major areas. The first one is process and pipeline management for projects. People are not considered that very important, but think about that. If you have 100 projects, you first need to establish like a big matrix of information about the project. You know, is it in that region or the other region? What is the, you know, potential revenue? Was it justified? What are the business drivers that behind it? And it's all about the project. You didn't start yet building tasks into that. You're not thinking about resource management. You're not just trying to justify another project or go after a project that you already justified before and that part of the execution list. So number one will be an ability to manage the project as an object inside a pipeline, similar to the way you're doing for CRM and a deal, okay? Number two will be resource management. Once you make a decision, do you have enough labor, enough budget, enough time, if too many things are running in parallel, so you need to look at resources to make sure you can do it. This is number one. Number three is the execution. So now you need to plan the project, track it, share it with people in a clear way. So I think that these three pillars, process management, resource management, and execution, this is what finally makes project portfolio management a thing. And it's very different from, for example, work management or productivity tools or Zoom-like applications that are really handling that today and tomorrow and next week and make it better for the team. I think that we are trying to make it better for the company, for the enterprise, to the management team. This is a very big difference between the
So between segments. The process management, resource management, and execution, mm-hmm. What do you solve the most, or what do you find in general is the hardest when it comes to project management?
You know, execution is quite trivial. If you have a timeline and you need to manage it some way, you need to find a way to manage it correctly, and this is what we call seamless execution. I think that resource management is relevant for the bigger companies. If you have more than, and you don't need to be too big, like 200 employees or more, 500 employees or more. You have enough resources, and then you have your bottlenecks, and then you think about what resources will be added next year, and this is where you need resource management. I think that process management starts where you have a portfolio. Like if you have 15, 20, 50, sometimes 250 projects that are about to be executed, or maybe half are being executed and half is still in the intake process, you must have a way to manage that as a process with workflows, with justification forms, with approvals, and all kinds of stuff.
You're a first-time founder, and you in the Army, you didn't necessarily do anything, the stereotypical places where a lot of entrepreneurs come out.
Yeah, I'm not an 8200.
Right,
yeah.
So you're not that, or you're 81. So where exactly are, so how did you get here? Is there anything you did in the Army that helped you get, what part of your career led to someone to just project management, not trying to dismiss it, but to go ahead and build a successful startup?
So I think that in Israel, entrepreneurship is everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts from school even.
Right.
You know, people are talking with you about that. You're hearing about that in the news. You're getting, you know, all these exits that people are talking about. And then, of course, when you're going to the Army, you continue being encouraged to do that. And even your family, you know, the Jewish mother is pushing you in this direction.
Right.
And then, you know, when you start, even if you're part of a big company, there are always discussions about how we are doing entrepreneurship inside a company. For example, when I was part of Intel for 6 or 8 years, there were many projects and initiatives in that space, like, doing a startup inside a corporate. So this was the language all along. I think that when I continue and finally made my executive MBA as part of the Israeli Technion, this was very focused on entrepreneurship and about building new companies and about thinking about new ideas. And once you start think, you know, along that lines, you start seeing all these gaps in reality. I'll give you just a very simple example. When I'm going out of my home in the morning in Shoham, I see many cars that are just parking across the street. And I started thinking, you know, these cars are not moving all day. So what can I do in order to help people use their cars better? So maybe we can open a network. And then if I need a car and this car is not moving, maybe I can open an application and ask someone to. So if you start looking at the reality with this kind of lens or eyes, then you start see all these opportunities to open a startup. And I think that it happened to me over the years, being part of the bigger companies, being part of an MBA team that was focused on that. And I started seeing that there is this gap in project management that continued growing. You know, the more the modern work environment is departing from the Gantt charts of the previous century, the more gaps you're seeing. You don't have a way to present to your management. You don't have a way to share information to a project team, a project status meeting. You don't have a way to collaborate over a timeline. And all these gaps finally led to me thinking, okay, we need to maybe come up with something that can close the gap.
The cut with him talking about the entrepreneurship, the Jewish mother thing, I think that'd be a good short. Yeah. So you'd see these problems, you see these issues, all the cars, and mm-hmm. you just start to think like that. You're seeing it from people around you. Basically, you're saying the culture and society has made you think like an entrepreneur.
Right. I think that this is very right. And, you know, when you're doing your first step, I think that also kick in is the type of, you know, the Israeli society, which is very close. And if you're an entrepreneur at the very early stages and you need help with something, it was amazing to find out that you can just call someone that you don't even know. And you're asking the person, like, carefully, can you help me maybe? I think I need 1 hour about marketing channels. Can you help me with that? And the other side is saying, oh, are you available this afternoon? Like, are you available tomorrow?
Right.
Because this is the type of relationship that are currently exists in the Israeli ecosystem. And people are really open to help other people. And of course, they know that it will be an opportunity for them down the road if they need something. And I think that it makes it easier to build and start a startup in Israel. And this is maybe what created the ecosystem that we're seeing here today with all these startups coming, you know, being built again and again. In Israel.
Yeah, people don't understand how important the speed is as in Israel. So yesterday morning, I was speaking to a man in Sydney, a cybersecurity marketer. And he invited me to follow his company's page. And I messaged him, do you want like to talk? So our marketer's like, sure. So now I'm like, great, what's your email? I took it to email, it was already scheduled. This was from Sunday to Monday, right? He's 7 hours ahead in Sydney. And then we get on the call, 9:30 a.m. Israel time. And he goes, you guys move fast. It's like, what am I supposed to wait for? I was like, I don't like, he's an immigrant from Singapore to Australia. And he goes, Australians are just way too chill and lazy. These are his words. Mm-hmm. That by the time they get to it, they would have sent the invite 4 days later. And then maybe an email, doesn't that like, just make it, just
it's
the
not
speed.
Like that.
You know, the speed that we move here is, at least in tech, unfortunately, I think we have a lot of, special interests and regulations and other issues in Israel that before the tech industry, but things just move so fast and it's so unique. I don't think we get anywhere else.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it makes it more dynamic and it also reduces the barrier for entry, because if you have access to other people and you know that they will respond,
right,
then it makes it easier for you to
you feel more comfortable reaching out.
Step. Yeah,
right. As
you
opposed
know,
to can you know
that you can, you know that you can do that.
Right, you can just go ahead and do it. It's amazing the response like that. And then I take that culture to America and people think I'm obnoxious. They probably think I'm like that here too, but even more so in America. So the Technion, right? The executive MBA, you went and did they encourage entrepreneurship? Because usually the point of school is to make you not think, in my opinion, right?
You know, I would even I'm not going to use the word encourage because they did significantly more than that. You know, the entire, it was 2.5 years. And from the very beginning, it was clear that they are trying to push you in that direction.
In like which direction?
In direction of building something your own.
Of like entrepreneurship.
Starting a company. Yeah.
Wait, the executive MBA that you did.
Yes.
Was the goal of that? Because if you were to take an executive MBA at a university in America, God forbid, don't go to any universities in America. But if you were to go to any of these evil institutions, they would push you to, they don't teach, push entrepreneurship. They push you how to get at the big corporate, like a Forbes 200.
Like be a good corporate
basically,
citizen.
Like, yeah. Wouldn't be surprised, half of their classes might be on like corporate politics, probably, wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, yeah.
Why is it so different at the Technion? Is it all Technion, is it just your executive MBA?
I think the executive MBA, even they're trying to differentiate themselves, so they even titled that like new technology companies, something like that. And from the very beginning, they're talking about how can you build a business plan, how you identify a good idea. There are many, meet the industry kind of discussions. We have entrepreneurs coming in. Some of them are serial entrepreneurs and are trying to help you like think about it, like think about the first phase of starting a company. So I think that they're not encouraging you. They're really pushing you strongly in order to go in that direction. And the last, the management game at the end of the executive MBA is about starting a company. So I think that they are really trying to do that. And I think that they're doing it successfully because over the years, there are so many, executive MBA graduates that are really opening startup companies. So I think that it works.
You said the executive MBA was 2.5 years, right?
Yes.
What made you decide to get an executive MBA at Technion?
You know, I was already working for Verifone. And I started feeling that I'm missing some, deeper and wider management knowledge. And since I was already an experienced manager myself, like with 10 or 12 years of experience, I was looking for something that will be a little more than just learning the basics. And I was looking at several executive MBAs.
You couldn't find that in the private industry? Like maybe you were just at the wrong job at Verifone or the wrong position or something?
No, it's not like going out there and meet some other people and do all the networking.
Just the thought of me going back to school sounds like really painful.
To be frank, it was a complete fun. I really enjoyed every minute of that. Like relearning some of the things I'm, familiar with, but you can always go one layer deeper. And really going through the more advanced courses of how to build a business plan. And I really enjoy that. And I think that it was a great decision. And I also encourage people that are, some people are doing it right after the first degree that they will do their MBA. I think it's not always the right thing to do because if you have some experience going through the MBA process, then you can learn more.
By the way, I agree, but people do that because it's a bullshit piece of paper. So they're trying to get it over with. Because I did that. Well, I graduated, I studied finance. And I graduated December 2008, so in the middle of the year. And there were just, there's the huge financial collapse a few months earlier. Mm-hmm. And Obama was just elected, who said he'll overregulate the banks, and there were no jobs. So, I came to Israel, and I waited like 10 months later, I started my MBA. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, like, for me, it was just like, okay, it seems like bureaucratic. That's why people do it.
Yeah.
But doesn't that imply people don't really learn much in their bachelor's?
No, I think that the executive MBAs are built differently. You know, I started the executive MBA at the age of 36. So, and people with me in the room were also like between, 34 to 40. So a lot of experience even in the room.
Right.
And you can learn a lot from that. And I think that this is maybe why it's more valuable.
So after you did you already have in mind that you were going to build Prozio while you're at the MBA? Or how did you transition from that into entrepreneurship?
So I think I had the original idea in mind, but it took me several additional years before I felt that this is like mature enough and I can do something with that. So not exactly after that, but maybe 3 or 4 years after.
That's a while. So what did you do during those 3 years?
I continued working as a PMO director.
Right, got
it. And I let the idea I build more information into the idea. I wrote the book, as I mentioned,
right.
And then started.
Well, the book in of itself is an entrepreneurial endeavor in a sense.
Yeah, it's not. It's just a way to articulate the idea. Because if you're
writing a book,
doing something great, let's say you're doing something really great, but then I'll ask you to build a pattern into that. Like, how exactly are you doing that? Like, in a way that someone else can read your book and do the same thing. Then you will have to invest some thinking process in that. Like, how can I do that? Like, what are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things that I'm doing in order to approach a project meeting correctly? So this is the process I went through.
Awesome. So starting the company, do you have co-founders?
Yeah, I have a co-founder, Barak Shibi, that was working with me in Verifone. He was a highly experienced R&D manager, and he started the company with me as a CTO. So from the beginning, we started he was responsible for all the technology part, putting together the platform and everything around that. And I was responsible for more the business side and to build the business case around it and to find the first investor and so forth.
And then, okay, so how did you find the first investor? So two of you, like, what did you bring to investors?
So, as always, it's a kind of a coincidence. We started thinking about the idea, and then I had to meet someone that maybe will be joining us as part of the founding
team. Was this while you were still Verifone, like you're doing this on the side, or are you?
I was already like in my last months with Verifone, and I was talking to someone that I thought will be part of the founding team, and then he said, I can't do that because I already started working with an investor, and so that's interesting. Let me meet your investor, and this investor happened to be a CEO of a company. And he was using one of our competitors' tools, and he was not very happy. And he's seeing our idea. Back then it was like maybe 4 slides, a PowerPoint with nothing in it. But he was smart enough to say, "Oh, there's something here." And he made the initial seed investment, and this is how we started. And after that, of course, there was a follow-up investment and some involvement of additional partners, so we can really do something with that. But I think that this was the first thing. It happened like in 2017.
So what did you, how much was the funding your first round?
Several hundreds.
Really
low.
Just to
yeah,
test it.
Yeah, just to, I think the beginning, the seed money is used in order to check that there is really something in it. Like you're building the very initial visuals, you're checking the technology just to make sure you're not shooting in the wrong direction. And once you are over that and you're getting to your first achievement, this is where you can maybe get more seed money or post-seed money to really come up with a solution. Because our solution at the end of the day, it's an enterprise solution. And you're not coming up with an enterprise solution in 2 months. You need to spend 2 years on that. There are so many features, so many modules that are part of an enterprise solution. So it took us between 2017 to, I would say, 2019 to say that we have a product that is really good enough for enterprises. And through this process, we work with seed money, later on with post-seed money from One Gulf Capital Partners. And then we got to the point where we can really offer an enterprise solution.
What was the hardest part of bringing your product like out there? Was it didn't have enough money, didn't have the right partners, getting enough people buying in or trying your product, what was the hardest?
I think you can have people trying your product if you provide it for free. And if you're using correctly, these circles of the 3F, like family, friends, fools,
right.
Then fools. You can get some initial feedback to the product. It's not the biggest issue. I think that the big issue at the beginning is that you don't have enough resources in order to make mistakes.
Right.
And you need to really think. You have one shot on selecting your development team. You have one shot of selecting a direction on the product level. And if you miss that, you're not going to have another opportunity. So I think this is very challenging, and you really need to be to carefully put your ego aside and to really make decisions that are based on the data that you are seeing and to base on things that you believe will work in the market and listen to your customers if you already have customers. So you can really go through this very hard initial phase.
So let's talk about the fundraising a little bit. So you found a family, a friend, or a fool to help you with the first 700,000 jokes aside, right? And then you start kind of building something that they saw you were on this thing, you're able to solve some kind of a problem. At what point how much of the product was prepared or developed before you went to ask for more funding?
I think it was not really a product back then. It was more of a proof of concept. I think any startup company, and we can talk about that in more details later today, will go through this process of doing the proof of concept. Like, it's not only an idea. It's something that I can really do something with, and you know, customers are positively reacting to that. Mm-hmm. So this is the proof of concept. Then you have the product market fit, and then you have your go-to-market. These are the three phases that you need to go through if you like to build something like that. So I think that we were completing the proof of concept. It looks good enough. There are positive feedback from customers. Some of them are already using that, and this allows for the next like funding round.
Awesome. So, and then how did you find them? Who introduced you? How did that work?
You know, again, because of the ecosystem in Israel, which is very large, there are many different investors you can approach. Of course, you need to do your homework and...
Wait, I want to stop you there. When you say there's a lot of the ecosystem in Israel, there's a lot of investors you can approach. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you mean just approach them? You email them and they'll take a meeting? Or
yeah,
what do you mean by approach? Because I think most people, at least not in Israel, when they're just going to approach a VC, they're just going to ignore you.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
So, first of all, VCs are not always ignoring you, because VCs, you know, they also need to develop their pipeline. And if you approach correctly, then they will say, oh, that's interesting enough. Let's talk to a guy. But you're right that the best approach will be with a reference. And here, you know, again, the Israeli network is very strong in that.
Right.
Like if you like to approach one of the early stage, you know, VCs, like let's say Aleph, like an right. example, then you can find someone that knows someone and can introduce you in a less cold
right.
way. And this is many times the right way to do that. But at the end of the day, it's not about, you know, the personal connection at the beginning. It's about, is it a good idea or not? Yeah, in order for you to be good, it should be part of a trend. You know, for example, if you do something in AI today, of course, it's more interesting. It should be differentiated correctly, not something that was, you know, is out there already. And, you know, investors, they know that. And it should be also the right timing, because you need to introduce something that had an opportunity to be successful now, and you need to explain why now is the right thing to do that. Like, for example, if I'm looking at Projo, the need for timelines that are not traditional Gantt chart was out there. This was the answer when people ask me, so why now? Because now they had enough from Gantt charts and they're looking for something else. This is why I can be successful. So I think that these are the parameters you need to follow if you like, you know, a seed stage VC to respond to your message.
Interesting. And then, so from there, you've grown and you have revenue and customers and clients, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the hardest part about getting to cash flow positivity?
To cash flow positivity?
Yeah.
I think that the beginning, it's not really your target. You're not trying to get to cash flow positivity from day one. And if you go back like 4 or 5 years ago, it was not even a target, even at the later stages. It was even a red flag for VCs. Like if you are cash positive, maybe it's because your idea is not strong enough and you're trying to like be a balanced company and just continue. But I think that recently, COVID-19 crisis, then the crisis in Europe, the inflation in the US, I think that profitability became more important, and even VCs, they know how to appreciate that these days. I think that you need to time it correctly, look at the funds that you have, and make sure that you can grow enough, because when you're growing, you're not profitable. But then get to profitability, or at least have a long-term plan to profitability in order to get there. Potentially, an investor will come like in between saying, you know, I'm not interested in that. Go ahead, continue a growth process. I'm not interested in profitability. That's a possibility. But generally speaking, build a company into profitability. It's a good idea these days.
Yeah, and you say these days because it wasn't the case just a few years ago.
Yeah, not a case, and it was counterproductive before.
Explain what you just said. You're saying profitability was counterproductive to raising money.
Right.
A few years ago, let's say before the recent inflation recession.
Because, you know, investors, they were thinking along the lines of, if I'm investing in a company and I'm giving you enough money, I'd like to see you growing aggressively, like two times a year, three times a year. And mm-hmm. then I trust that the next investor will continue fund the company and you can continue this growth path. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, it works, especially when the market is really high yeah. and strong, it works. But when you have years like 2022, 2023, like funding resources was not available, then these companies that are really growing fast and then they must find the next investor are having difficulties. While if you are closer to profitability with relatively low amount of money, you can continue your process. And I think that this is why it became more relevant.
It reminds me of investing in real estate. It's when you invest for appreciation, not cash flow, is that you make your profit based on when you acquired the real mm-hmm. estate, not more than, it's yeah. more important than when you
and,
sell.
You know, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that this model is completely not relevant. Like,
right,
you know,
but it's
I think that.
Right.
There is more appreciation
to the
other model.
Why aren't VCs looking for, I understand VCs may, let's say everyone's tightening their belt and they may be looking for more safer, smaller profitable opportunities. Maybe they'll take more, less risk, let's say. But aren't there still great opportunities? Are companies still being able, you can get in early and all that? Have they?
Yeah, you know,
are they still focused on it as much at all? Or
yeah, no, there are opportunities. Again, I'm not saying that it's completely not relevant anymore to grow faster. Of course, it's a great thing. And VCs, you know, are still very appreciative of that. But there are other financial bodies in the market, like private equities
right.
and other investors that are looking also for
right.
profitability.
Right.
So I think that it's not like moving from one to the other, but I think that there is a trend and people are looking more on profitability these days.
And you've raised how much so far?
We raised about 14 million, almost nice. 14 million, most of it in an A round
nice,
that
yeah.
we did at the end of 2021 with about $8 million. It was announced publicly. And before that, it was like seed money, some Israel Innovation Authority money.
Oh, cool. We'll be interviewing them
yeah.
In another 2 months.
Yeah.
Do you worry that, like, you know, with so much uncertainty in the world, not to mention war, inflation, politics, economics, trade, that, like, you're ever going to, like, do you have any kind of anxiety that you're not going to be able to get to cash flow positivity? I feel that I'm feeling a lot of anxiety in general from other founders and things like that, that, you know, things are so dramatically changed that there's the more uncertainty might provide more anxiety. Are
so,
you, do you
know,
feel
my,
that yourself?
My job as a CEO is to be concerned.
Okay.
This is my job. So if I'll yeah. tell you I'm not concerned about something, then something went wrong.
Right.
Of course I'm concerned and you know, the need to strategically plan for profitability in our case or strategic plan for growth and for hiring is always out there. In our case, we're really doing it longer term. Like, you know, I think that we are following a strategy since the beginning of 2022, and we're still executing on that strategy. Having said that, yeah, there is a very significant concern in the market for the smaller company, like the startups, because, yeah, 2022, 2023, they were hard, but it looks like 2024 is also, you know, another hard year because we're not seeing the recovery yet in the market, not seeing the recovery yet, you know, with VCs and private equities. So probably it's 2025. And this is a lot
yeah,
of time to
and
go
probably
through.
Probably 2026.
Like, yeah, so this is one concern. I think that the other concern is really the new technology. You know, AI technology is really a threat today to many industries and domains. You know, if AI technology gets to, I don't know, CRM, maybe it can kill some of the CRM ideas that are out there and people are paying for that for a long time. I think that that concern, specifically in the project management space, it's an opportunity, another concern, because it's not likely with the existing technology that AI-based system will start managing projects for organizations that require too much people management and face-to-face interactions, and it's not really possible to do it only with a machine. But at the same time, there are great opportunities in that space, especially for a company like us, because we have a patent in the space, and we know how to analyze information in a way that enable AI. There are great opportunities to use the technology. You know, everyone are familiar with that ChatGPT NLP technology. So this is one, but also generative AI can be used, and many ideas that can make the project management life and day to day easier. A great opportunity for us, but generally it's still a threat. You know, AI technology is the new thing that people need to look at and plan accordingly.
And so where do you see Progeo and you and what you're doing differently in the next year or two? Or do you see Israeli tech changing in the near future?
I think that if we go back to AI, this is a major part of our focus this year, and of course will be also next year, embedding this technology in our solution in a way that it helps users to do the work faster and to get you know, to get access to data faster. And I think that other than that, if I'm looking forward, it's also integrations. You need to know how to work inside the enterprise ecosystem and to connect to other system in enterprise, either natively through your app or with the open API. But this is definitely a must. The more tools you have out there, the more flexibility and dynamic you have out there. This is also something we're looking at for 24 and 25.
Awesome. Yaniv Shore, thank you so much. Founder and CEO of Progeo. We'll put everywhere to follow you and Progeo down in the description. Thank you so much for being on Israel Tech.
Thank you very much.